for this March 17th. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us, and here are some of your Wednesday headlines. The IRS is planning to extend the tax filing deadline until mid-May. According to the chair of two key House committees, the deadline will move from April 15th to May 17th. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell striking a note of cautious optimism as the central bank signals it believes the recovery from the coronavirus recession is accelerating. Authorities saying it is too early to know whether the shooting spree in Atlanta was motivated by hate. Eight people are dead. The suspect has confessed. Russia has recalled its ambassador to the U.S. after President Biden vowing that Russian leader Vladimir Putin would, quote, pay a price for the country's efforts to interfere in the 2020 election. And in that ABC News interview, the president also opening the door to a Senate rule change on the filibuster. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin in Atlanta with the shooting that took place yesterday. Several shootings. The suspect is Robert Aaron Long. Police say he confessed to three separate attacks, which killed a total of eight people. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms saying that the suspect's family, in fact, helped police in their search. And at the White House, this from President Biden.
I was just on the telephone briefed by the Attorney General of the United States and the Director of the FBI. And the investigation is ongoing. And the question of motivation is still to be determined. But whatever the motivation here, I know that Asian Americans are in very concerned because, as you know, I've been speaking about the brutality against Asian Americans for the last couple months, and I think it is very, very troubling. But I'm making no connection at this moment to the motivation of the killer. I'm waiting for an answer from, as the investigation proceeds, from the FBI and from the Justice Department. So I'll have more to say when the investigation is completed.
And we should point out six of the women who died are of Asian descent. Reacting to those shootings in the Atlanta area, Vice President Kamala Harris.
But before I begin, I do want to talk about what happened in Georgia, in Atlanta. It is tragic. Our country, the president and I and all of us, we grieve for the loss. Our prayers are extended to the families of those who have been killed. And it speaks to a larger issue, which is the issue of violence in our country and what we must do to never tolerate it and to always speak out against it. The investigation is ongoing. We don't yet know. We're not yet clear about the motive. But I do want to say to our Asian American community that we stand with you and understand how this has frightened and shocked and outraged all people, but knowing the increasing level of hate crime against our Asian American brothers and sisters, we also want to speak out in solidarity with them and acknowledge that none of us should ever be silent in the face of any form of hate.
That from Vice President Kamala Harris. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution is reporting that some preliminary information indicates that the killings may not have been racially motivated, but instead could relate to the suspect's claim of a potential sex addiction. Nevertheless, a rise in attacks against Asian Americans nationwide is troubling. The shootings bringing this response from California Representative Judy Chu.
Yesterday, in Atlanta, eight people were killed as a result of three shootings at Asian spas that occurred within a few hours. Six of the eight victims were Asian American women. It appears the shooter, age 21, a white male, first went to a spa called Young's Asian Massage. The fact that he went to that one with that title gives you a clue as to what he was thinking. This is one of the more violent tragedies in a string of about 3,800 hate incidents and crimes against Asian Americans, 68% of them women. It's clear that the individuals were targeted because they are amongst the most vulnerable in our country, immigrant Asian women. The AAPI community has been living in fear of verbal and physical attacks, and now we're experiencing increasingly deadly tragedies of racism and violence. We call on Georgia officials to ensure that the families of the victims are well supported and our followers to support local efforts that provide community protection and victim support. And we express our deepest condolences to the friends and families of these victims. The AAPI community tells us that they have been living in a steady state of tension this entire pandemic. Yesterday's crimes are beyond terrifying, but it just brings home to so many Asian Americans that they are fearful of their lives and circumstances where they would otherwise feel safe in their homes and at their jobs. And not only that, they are risking infection when going to work at places like a spa or a nail salon, and now they're risking increased targeted violence.
Those comments earlier today from California Representative Judy Chu, and joining us on the phone is Ryan Miller. He is following the story for USA Today. It seems tonight that there are more questions than answers. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so authorities in the Atlanta area earlier today said they're still investigating whether or not what occurred at the three spas was in fact a hate crime. Atlanta Police Chief Rodney Bryant said that we're just not there yet. The Cherokee County Sheriff's officials, however, said that in interviews with the suspect, he indicated that a sexual addiction was his motivation in committing the shootings. But obviously, various lawmakers and advocacy groups have pointed to the recent rise in hate incidences against Asian Americans, and sort of seeing this as continuing that trend.
And it seems, based on your reporting at usatoday.com, that the suspect's family played a key role in apprehending him.
That's correct. Yeah. When shortly after the first shooting occurred in Cherokee County around 5 p.m. on Tuesday, sheriff's officials released surveillance photos of the suspect. And the sheriff there, Frank Reynolds, said that the suspect's family immediately got in contact with them and believed that it might be their son. And they cooperated with sheriff's officials to track their son as he was continuing through the state.
And based on what you've been seeing and hearing over the last 24 hours, what's next? The suspect has basically said, yes, I did this.
That's correct. During the press conference, police indicated that in an interview he had admitted to the shootings. He's been charged in Cherokee County, I believe, with four counts of murder and then one assault count. There was one man who was injured. Charges are still pending in Atlanta, where four other people were killed at two spas.
A story that we will continue to follow. Ryan Miller of USA Today, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And now to the economy. In today's Fed meeting, the Wall Street Journal reporting the following, quote, "The Federal Reserve kept its easy money policies in place and vowed to maintain them until the U.S. economy recovers further from the effects of the coronavirus pandemic, while also highlighting the brightening outlook for growth. Most of the 18 Fed officials at the meeting still expecting to hold short-term interest rates to near zero through 2023. That according to updated economic projections released today. But seven now expect to start lifting rates in 2022 or early 2023. That is up from five in December. More details at WSJ.com. Following today's meeting, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, speaking to reporters.
Today, the FOMC kept interest rates near zero and maintained our sizable asset purchases. These measures, along with our strong guidance on interest rates and on our balance sheet, will ensure that monetary policy will continue to deliver powerful support to the economy until the recovery is complete. The path of the economy continues to depend significantly on the course of the virus and the measures undertaken to control its spread. Since January, the number of new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths has fallen, and ongoing vaccinations offer hope for a return to more normal conditions later this year.
And yet, the other economic concern remains inflation. Axios.com reporting the following, quote, "Inflation worries have taken center stage among investors with a recent survey from Bank of America showing that it has displaced the coronavirus pandemic as the top concern among global fund managers. Consumers have also shown increasing worries with inflation expectations rising to their highest level in 7 years. That according to the New York Fed, and many concerns on inflation from everything from gas to food prices. Now, 1 year into this pandemic, the Fed chair is speaking about COVID-19 and what it means for the economy moving ahead.
Hi, Chair Powell, and thanks for that. So could you talk us through how the forecasts for 2021 map into the substantial further progress definition, 2.4% inflation? I understand that's considered transitory. That still seems like some progress there, 4.5% unemployment. Is it time to start talking about tapering yet?
Not yet. As you pointed out, we've said that we would continue asset purchases at this pace until we see substantial further progress. And that's actual progress, not forecast progress. So, and that's a difference from our past approach. So, and what we mean by that is pretty straightforward. It is we'll want to see that that the labor market conditions have moved, have made substantial progress toward maximum employment, and inflation has made substantial progress toward the 2% goal. That's what we're going to want to see. Now, that obviously includes an element of judgment. And when we see, we'll be carefully looking ahead. We also understand that we will want to provide as much advance notice of any potential taper as possible. So when we see that we're on track, when we see actual data coming in that suggests that we're on track to perhaps achieve substantial further progress, then we'll say so. And we'll say so well in advance of any decision to actually taper.
If I could follow up on that, the shift in the dots, why wouldn't that suggest a weakening of the commitment here? An awful lot of people shifted into 2022, it seems.
I don't see that at all. You know, we have a range of perspectives on the committee. I welcome that. And, we debate things, we discuss things, and we always come together around a solution. But, the strong bulk of the committee is not showing a rate increase during this forecast period. And, as data improve, as the outlook improves very significantly since the December meeting, you would expect forecasts to move up. It's probably not a surprise that some people would bring in their estimate of the appropriate time for liftoff. Nonetheless, the bulk of the committee, the largest part by far of the committee, is doesn't show a rate increase during this period. And again, part of that is wanting to see actual data rather than just a forecast at this point. We do expect that we'll begin to make faster progress on both spending, labor markets and inflation as the year goes on because of the progress with the vaccines, because of the fiscal support that we're getting. We expect that to happen, but, we'll have to see it first.
That from earlier today, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell. And on Wall Street, the Dow rose nearly 190 points. The Nasdaq was up 53, the S&P rising 11. During a hearing before the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, Dr. Anthony Fauci saying that the U.S. could have enough data to begin vaccinating children under the age of 12 and under in the first quarter of 2022. Dr. Fauci's testimony comes a day after Moderna announcing the first tests of its COVID vaccine in children ranging in age from 6 months to less than 12 years. Meanwhile, the CDC announcing today that the agency is, quote, actively looking at additional studies on whether schools can safely reopen with students spaced 3 feet apart rather than 6 feet apart. The agency director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, testifying before the House committee as well. She didn't give a specific timeline, but earlier in the day at a White House briefing, she did offer some new guidelines for COVID testing overall.
Today, CDC is releasing a suite of 5 updated guidance documents on COVID-19 testing, building on the latest science, available testing options, and what we have learned about testing during this pandemic. Our testing overview guidance describes the available tests that are used to detect COVID-19, how to choose a test, and the reasons for using them. They also explain the impact of vaccination on testing. Importantly, until now, limited test capacity has resulted in our use of tests for largely diagnostic purposes, when someone presents with symptoms or has been exposed. Only in selected places have we capitalized on the benefits of how testing can be used as a screening intervention with frequent tests to identify asymptomatic disease and prevent clusters before they start. Testing can also be used as a surveillance tool to monitor the burden of disease in communities. Our newly released set of guidances offers a comprehensive approach to testing and helps to prevent the spread of COVID-19 through the rapid identification and isolation of people who are infected, including those who do not know they are infected because they do not have symptoms. The updated overview also provides new information about how health equity issues related to testing. To end this pandemic, everyone must have equal access to affordable and timely testing with fast turnaround time for results to identify infections and reduce community spread. In addition to the overview guidance, we are also releasing 4 complementary guidance documents that focus on testing in specific settings, including correctional and detention facilities, non-healthcare workplaces, institutions of higher education, and homeless shelters and encampments. Each of these companion documents, guidance documents, provide tailored recommendations that take into account the unique circumstances and risks for COVID-19 spread in the different settings. Today's updated guidance is intended to help public health officials, medical providers, school and justice system administrators, and others make decisions about setting up testing programs in their communities. All 5 guidance documents are now posted on our website at cdc.gov.
That from earlier today, Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She is the director of the CDC. The Biden administration also expanding coronavirus testing for teachers, staff, and students. Also convening a summit for educators to share best practices for those students returning to the classroom. That summit, by the way, is scheduled for a week from today, next Wednesday. And to the Education Secretary, Miguel Cardona, announcing the allocation of $10 billion for testing that would accelerate those reopenings.
We're at a critically important time in our nation's history in education, and I'm honored to serve as the Secretary of Education. My goal, my priority right now is to safely reopen as many schools as possible, as quickly as possible. And earlier today, I notified all 50 states, D.C., and Puerto Rico of the amount of funds they'll be receiving from the American Rescue Plan, totaling nearly $122 billion to help them reopen safely and quickly. I'm also pleased to share that HHS is allocating an additional $10 billion for states to do screening and surveillance testing in schools to make sure we can not only open our schools, but keep them open. And then thirdly, I'm really, really excited to announce that next week we will be having our national reopening summit for schools, where we're going to hear best practices from across the country on how to do this safely and how to do it quickly, because we know there are great examples out there. We know students learn best from students, teachers learn best from teachers, and states will learn best from states on how to safely reopen schools quickly.
That from the Education Secretary, and Dr. Jill Biden, who teaches at a community college in Northern Virginia, will also be among those speaking at that summit next Wednesday. We, of course, will be covering it for the C-SPAN networks. And this story, which has been getting a lot of attention today, Republican attorneys general from 21 states questioning a provision in the $1.9 trillion pandemic rescue plan that would bar states from using those funds to offset any tax cuts. In a letter to the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Monday, the attorneys general saying that the prohibition is, quote, unclear but potentially breathtaking, airing concerns that any tax cut would be construed as taking advantage of the pandemic relief funds. Now, the attorneys general listing over a dozen instances of states currently considering new tax credits or tax cuts that they believe could be jeopardized simply because they accepted the relief funds. And so for more on that story, we talked late today to Washington Post White House reporter Jeffrey Stein. He explained the issue led by the following 3 states, Georgia, Arizona, and West Virginia.
So what's going on here is that in the Biden stimulus bill, they included a sort of staggering amount of money for states and cities. But as they were speeding towards final passage of the bill, they sort of realized, a lot of the Democrats, particularly the centrist Democrats, realize that if we turn around and give this money to the states, they may in turn use it to cut taxes. A lot of states have not been dealt with that severe blows to their financial picture. So there's this thinking that maybe Republican governors will do tax cuts with this money that the Democrats don't want them to. But as a result, the Republicans are very obviously opposed to this provision. And so they are preparing, and we reported today that the Ohio Attorney General, backed by other Republican attorneys general across the country, are planning to oppose, in one case at least, file a lawsuit against the Biden administration, arguing that these restrictions on the potential uses of this fund is, in fact, unconstitutional.
We have been hearing from Senate Republicans, people like Senator Mitt Romney of Utah and John Barrasso of Wyoming, basically saying that many of these states do not need the money.
And, you know, they actually have a point about this. If you look at the projections for revenue declines, they were really, really scary last summer when it looked like, you know, sort of the bottom was falling out, you know, under the economy. But since then, things have really stabilized, and there are a lot of states that are seeing not just not severe deficits, but are actually seeing surpluses. The state of California, for instance, has had a relatively healthy surplus as tech has really boomed during the pandemic, and in part due to the massive amounts of government spending authorized by Congress over the last year. So, you know, it is the case that there are many states and many cities that are still really desperately struggling. Alaska, Hawaii, Texas, state, you know, Louisiana, states dependent on tourism revenue and gambling revenue and things like that are really, really suffering and desperately need help. But Congress, you know, still approved lots of money for states, including those that are not really suffering. And so what happens with this pot of money is going to be a huge political fight in the next few months.
Bottom line, the argument from these Republican attorneys generals across the state, 21 in total, their argument is what?
That if the federal government is going to provide aid to the states in this emergency, they shouldn't so carefully dictate how the money could be used. It's worth noting, of course, that money is fungible. And so it's not really clear if, you know, Congress even has the ability, or the Biden administration even has the ability to prevent, you know, dollar X from being used in a certain way, given that, you know, as I said, money is fungible and they can just, you know, take money from other purposes and reprogram it for tax cuts if they want. This is, you know, one of the elements of the stimulus plan that Biden himself, I've heard, is very fixated on. The Obama White House really adamantly believed that one of the big problems was with the last bill was that they did not adequately address state and local governments hemorrhaging jobs. And so this is something that they're going to try to address this time, but unclear given the resistance from Republicans.
And do you know if, for example, Arizona, Georgia, West Virginia, some of the states involved in this lawsuit, if they use it for tax cuts, can the federal government say, we want that money back?
Yeah, so this is in the bill, and it looked like one of those things that kind of got slapped together at the very last minute as a way of making sure centrist Democrats voted for the bill. And so it's really unclear if that will that provision will hold or if it could be stricken down by the courts at a certain point.
More details at WashingtonPost.com. Jeffrey Stein, thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much.
And welcome back to Washington Today for this Wednesday. Here are two additional headlines related to coronavirus. Nearly 40 million Americans have been fully vaccinated. That is 12% of the total population, according to new data from the CDC. And Disneyland announcing plans to reopen on April 30th. However, only California residents may visit the park in line with current state guidelines. In an ABC News interview taped yesterday that aired this morning on Good Morning America, President Biden saying that he supports changing the Senate's filibuster rule, changing it back to requiring senators to talk on the floor to hold up a bill. This marking the first time he has endorsed reforming the procedure that for weeks the White House has said he is opposed to eliminating. Right now, 60 votes are needed in the Senate to end debate and pass legislation. That is a threshold that requires Democrats to have the support of at least 10 Republicans to advance a bill in what is now a 50-50 Senate. Many Democrats are worried that the filibuster could hold up major agenda items such as voting rights and immigration reform. But as we heard earlier this week on the Senate floor, Republican leader Mitch McConnell saying the changes to the filibuster would create, in his words, chaos in the U.S. Senate. Here is part of that ABC News interview with President Biden.
What's next on your legislative agenda?
If you notice, the criticism of the COVID relief package, my Republican friends, is they say it spends too much money and it gives too many tax breaks. All these tax breaks go to the bottom 60% of the population. And guess what? They need it. The $1,400 check. child care tax credit. They don't like it because, in fact, their idea of a tax cut is to give the Trump tax cut where 83% went to the top 1% of the people in America.
You're going to be raising those taxes.
Yes. Anybody making more than $400,000 will see a small to a significant tax increase. If you make less than $400,000, you won't see one single penny in additional federal tax.
But let's talk raw politics here. You didn't get a single Republican vote for tax cuts. How are you going to get a Republican vote for a tax increase?
Well, I may not get but I'll get the Democratic votes for a tax increase. If we just took the tax rate back to what it was when Bush was president, top rate paid 39.6% in federal taxes, that would raise $230 billion. Yet they're complaining because I'm providing a tax credit for child care for the poor, for the middle class.
You just say you're not likely to get Republican votes for the tax increase. You're not likely to get Republican votes for H.R. 1, expanding voting rights, or the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. So aren't you going to have to choose? I know you've been reluctant to do away with the filibuster. Aren't you going to have to choose between preserving the filibuster and advancing your agenda?
Yes. But here's the choice. I don't think you have to eliminate the filibuster. You have to do it what it used to be when I first got to the Senate. And that is that a filibuster, you had to stand up and command the floor. Once you stopped talking, you lost that, and someone could move in and say, I move the question of. So you got to work for the filibuster.
So you're for that reform. You're for bringing back the talking filibuster.
I am. That's what it was supposed to be.
Just put a hold on it. That's it.
Yeah. It almost is getting to the point where democracy is having a hard time functioning. I'm not saying this is going to be easy, George, but I do believe there's enough Republicans over time.
They haven't had that epiphany you said you were going to see in the campaign.
No, well, I've only been here 6 weeks, pal. Okay, give me a break.
And that's from President Biden in an ABC News interview with George Stephanopoulos. A number of Democrats have been pressuring Democratic leaders to use their majority in the Senate, eliminating the filibuster, or at least alter the rules. But this cautionary note from the Senate floor, a Republican, John Cornyn of Texas.
It appears that our friends across the aisle are experiencing an existential crisis when it comes to deciding how to manage their newfound powers in the majority. We're just 2.5 months in this new Congress, and already we're hearing the majority leader and many on the other side of the aisle threatening to blow up the rules of the Senate. After decades as a senator, President Biden even yesterday relented and threw his support behind the plan. The filibuster has been called into question a number of times over the past few years. That's to be expected, but it's just that our Democratic friends used to be on the other side of the argument. They took one position when they were in the minority where the filibuster protected their rights, and now they're in a majority. Many of them are looking to eliminate any minority rights and to fundamentally change the Senate. In 2018, our Democratic colleagues were afraid the Republican Senate majority would blow up the filibuster. I'm not really sure why they were concerned. After all, Senator McConnell and Republican senators have consistently defended the rights of the minority by use of the legislative filibuster, even when President Trump called for it to be eliminated. But our Democratic friends keep piling on.
We carry the Senate live on C-SPAN 2 and those comments earlier today on the filibuster debate that continues in the U.S. Senate with Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas. Meanwhile, in the House today, lawmakers voting to renew what has been the lapsed Violence Against Women Act, the final vote in the House, 244 to 172. The bill adding on previous versions of the law by authorizing funding for grants and other forms of support, all in an effort to prevent and combat sexual assault, domestic violence, dating violence, stalking, and deliver assistance to those victims. The legislation introduced in the House by a number of leading Democrats, including Representative Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas.
Madam Speaker, I stand today in a moment of history where we cannot go back. Have we heard that before? Women cannot go back. Women cannot continue in an intimidated fashion to tragically be subjected to men who violently attack them. LGBT community cannot go back and be subjected to those who be violent against them. Native American women, they cannot go back. They cannot go back. They cannot go back from pueblos and reservations and not have any protection for those who violate those sacred places, rape them, and then rush to jurisdictions outside and think they are protected. Immigrant women cannot go back. That is what this legislation is about. It is a product born of meticulous and thoughtful research and countless engagement with those on the ground working ultimately and intimately on these very important issues daily.
That from Representative Sheila Jackson Lee. The debate earlier today in the House of Representatives, even with Democratic support in the House, the effort will face an uncertain future in the Senate with a 50-50 partisan split. More on that issue of the filibuster and whether Republicans will halt the legislation. Voicing his opposition in the House is Virginia Republican Congressman Bob Good earlier today.
Democrats are using domestic violence, which is a serious issue, as a front for just their latest gun control bill. This legislation contains red flag confiscation language and expands the grounds for lifetime bans of firearm possession. Red flag gun confiscation laws upend due process. Under this legislation, an individual could have their guns removed from them without having the chance to face their accuser in court. That means a complaint and a judicial order could suspend a constitutionally guaranteed right with no chance for the accused to respond under the law. This legislation makes it clear that Democrats consider gun ownership a second-class right, if it's a right at all, and view the Constitution as a negotiable suggestion. This bill would expand the number of nonviolent misdemeanor offenses that produce a lifetime ban on firearm ownership, which is already applied to felons. It's ironic that in the same week that Democrats are voting in support of amnesty for illegal aliens who've committed up to two misdemeanors, they're voting to permanently suspend the constitutional rights of Americans who've committed one nonviolent misdemeanor. I oppose this attempt to undermine due process, further restrict the Second Amendment, and expand the left's radical and relentless gun control agenda.
That from Congressman Good of Virginia, Republican. Again, the final vote in the House, 244 to 172, the passage of the Violence Against Women Act. The Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas telling lawmakers that the U.S.-Mexico border is in fact secure, repeating that it is, quote, not open. His appearance before the House Homeland Security Committee comes as the White House looking to house and care for what is a growing number of children who are crossing into the U.S.-Mexico border, and they're crossing against the backdrop of a pandemic that has already strained resources in the region. This, by the way, marking the secretary's first time testifying on Capitol Hill since his confirmation. And at one point, this exchange over how to describe the border situation with Florida Republican Kat Kamick.
Can you tell me what FEMA stands for?
The Federal Emergency Management Administration.
Excellent. So since FEMA has been now deployed to the border, that would stand to reason that there is an emergency on the border, correct?
Congresswoman, perhaps you did not hear me.
Yes or no will suffice.
We have a very serious challenge at the border, and we are tackling it.
So FEMA being the emergency management administration, they deal with emergencies, and they are now being deployed to the border, and it's not an emergency? Is that what I'm hearing?
Congresswoman, if you'll allow me, FEMA, the men and women of FEMA, have tremendous capabilities, operational capabilities to address challenges that we confront in a series of our mission sets.
I'm so sorry. I have to reclaim my time because I'm very limited. And I'm glad you said that because the men and women of FEMA are incredible. And I represent a hurricane-prone state, so this is really important to me, especially as the ranking member of the Emergency Preparedness and Response and Recovery Subcommittee. So with everything that we have going on, a global pandemic, a border crisis, with everything happening, does FEMA have the resources necessary to effectively respond to the pandemic, the border crisis, and the upcoming hurricane season, in your opinion?
Yes.
And again, yes, they do?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes, let me share with you a glowing example of that. As I said at the outset, the president set an ambitious goal for FEMA to set up 100 federally supported community vaccination centers in 30 days. They mm-hmm. stood up 441 in 30 days, and the number is over 900 today. Their capabilities are extraordinary, and I have tremendous confidence in their ability to provide the assistance that they are to Health and Human Services in addressing
and that critical infrastructure, right?
Children, in handling the issue of the unaccompanied children arriving in large numbers at our southwest border, and their other mission sets. Tremendous confidence.
That's from the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and Kat Koenig is a Florida Republican representative in the exchange earlier today before the House Homeland Security Committee. As of Tuesday, more than 300 unaccompanied migrant children had been in Border Patrol custody for more than 10 days. We should point out federal law requires unaccompanied children to be turned over within 72 hours to the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees shelter networks designed to house those minors. Well, Russia has called back its Russian envoy to its U.S. envoy to Moscow for consultations. This after President Biden referred to his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, as, quote, a killer, and said Vladimir Putin would pay a price for meddling in the 2020 U.S. election. We talked about it yesterday, but the president's comments on ABC's Good Morning America following the release of that declassified report from the Director of National Intelligence that claimed the Kremlin interfered in the presidential election last year. Here's a portion of that ABC News interview.
What price must he pay?
He will pay a price. We had a long talk, he and I. I know him relatively well. And the conversation started off, I said, I know you and you know me. If I establish this occurred, then be prepared.
You said you know he doesn't have a soul.
I did say that to him, yes. And his response was, we understand one another. I wasn't being a wise guy. I was alone with him in his office. That's how it came about. It was when President Bush had said, I've looked in his eyes and saw a soul. I said, looked in your eyes, and I don't think you have a soul. And looked back at me and said, we understand each other. Look, most important thing dealing with foreign leaders, in my experience, and I've dealt with an awful lot of them over my career, is just know the other guy.
So you know Vladimir Putin. You think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So what price must he pay?
The price he's going to pay, well, you'll see shortly. I'm not going to, by the way, we ought to be able, that trite expression, walk and chew gum at the same time. There are places where it's in our mutual interest to work together. That's why I renewed the START agreement with him. That occurred while he's doing this, but that's overwhelming in the interest of humanity that we diminish the prospect of a nuclear exchange.
The full interview available at abcnews.com. Not only Russia, but also Iran engaged in covert influence campaigns, according to the DNI report, aimed at swaying the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. Danielle Pletka is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and she offered her reaction when we spoke late today.
So what struck me the most, ironically, was the dog that didn't bark. The intelligence report suggested that Russia, rather more aggressively, but also Iran, tried to interfere in the U.S. elections, tried to steer both doubt in our election processes and divisions within our society, but that the Russians were more aggressive. What was amazing to me was that the assessment was that the Chinese were not trying to do that, which seemed to me to be, how can I say this in a nice way, Beijing. So it was a kind of an interesting report.
It comes on the same day that a letter was released by Tennessee Senator Bill Hagerty, and you write about this on the AEI website, but warning the president of increasing aggression from Iran. What is happening? What should we be concerned about?
Well, I think that what we're experiencing is a new administration that has come in with an avowedly softer, more warm policy towards Tehran. And the Iranians are testing the Biden administration to see just how far they can push them. They recognized that they were not going to be able to push the Trump administration in the direction that they had hoped. Biden comes in. He says, I want America to go back into the Iran deal, the so-called JCPOA. I want America to resume kind of where it left off. And I want Iran to come back into compliance with the deal. And so the Iranians are trying to figure out just what they need to do to get some cash out of the Americans.
And as you point out at AEI.org, will the actions of Biden's Iran team match its words? explain.
Well, here's the challenge. So, you know, Joe Biden went a long way in trying to emphasize to the American people that his was not going to be a third term of the Obama administration. And, you know, a couple months in, it's hard for us to tell whether that's the case or not. But on Iran, you know, what we've seen is that while the administration has talked a pretty tough game, for example, in the aftermath of a direct attack on U.S. contractors by Iranian proxies, the Biden administration authorized a retaliatory strike in Syria. You know, so they're suggesting that they're not going to be as eager as Team Obama was to make nice with Iran. But of course, the facts are that these are exactly, and when I say exactly, I mean exactly, the same people who cut the Obama deal with Iran that was so much disliked in the Congress and obviously by the GOP. And what I write in the piece is that while all of these folks who are up for various nominations in the Biden administration make great pains to say, you know, we're going to go slow, the world isn't the same as it used to be, the reality is that over the last 4 years, that's not what they were saying. They were saying, we need to get right back in. The deal can never be better. We need to make nice with the Iranians. The only other choice is war. So you got to kind of ask yourself, do we believe what they said in their hearings, or do we believe what they've been saying for the last 4 years?
So based on that, what is your biggest concern? What would you tell the Secretary of State and the President in dealing with Iran? Because it's obvious that there's a lot of distrust.
There is a lot of distrust. And, you know, the Iranians, to be fair to them, insofar as it's necessary, don't trust us either. They went into a deal with the United States and Donald Trump ripped it up. So what I would say is that the Iranians are extraordinarily good hagglers. They are committed to a nuclear weapons program, and they are committed to continuing a missile program, which will enable delivery of those nuclear weapons. They are committed to supporting the terrorist proxies that they've worked with for decades, including Hezbollah, including the Houthis in Yemen, including Hamas in the West Bank. And if the Biden administration thinks that they can pick and choose which challenges to face up to with Iran and just deal with the other ones down the road, they are sorely mistaken.
Danielle Pletka, she is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. The website, AEI.org, joining us here in Washington. We thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
And finally, a reminder, be sure to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. This program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. So be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. I'm Steve Scully for the Wednesday edition. Hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening and, of course, a very happy St. Patrick's Day.